Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
If you concentrate wealth, it's quite clear you are going to concentrate political power. Folks often talk as if economics and politics are in these separate arenas, which is ridiculous. It's all in one arena, and the concentration of wealth affects the distribution of power. And it's a very simple observation. You cannot have an economic system that concentrates wealth and expect to have a political system which distributes power. And we see that today in the United States.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen on his newest book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Stay tuned.
We're very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Robert Jensen. He is the author of Arguing for Our Lives. It's a beautiful book, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Now, we look, at critical thinking as something that, as a terminology of education. People in education often speak about critical thinking. But I find the idea of critical pedagogy that Paul Freire, inspired in the late 70s, in the 70s, has been completely removed from the critical thinking of today. And so what are we talking about when we're creating critical arguments in order to create dialogue?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that some of the original ideas about critical thinking, such as Freire, as you're saying, were focused on helping people think about power, especially people on the bottom of hierarchies who had to struggle to resist that power. So there was always a politics to that conception of critical thinking, a politics of resistance, you could say, to concentrations of power. But like many things, when they become adopted by big institutions, they lose that political edge. And I think critical thinking is a good example of that. So in my book, I'm trying to talk about critical thinking brought to bear on some of the more fundamental questions about that distribution of power. You know, critical thinking is not some magical power that you have to study to learn. It's really just about recognizing what are the fundamental questions we struggle to answer and how do we get to those most successfully. Unfortunately, a lot of academic life often is about obscuring those fundamental questions, not highlighting them.
In your book, I was particularly drawn to your chapter on power basics, political, but more than politics. And yep. Here, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between this kind of elitist view of intellectual life as something that is performed by a particular sector of the population, but not, accessible to the rest of the population.
Right. A lot of academic life, I think, is kind of mystifying what is a pretty basic human ability to systematically look at the world and try to observe patterns and understand how the world works. Now, of course, there are some fields that are highly technical and require a lot of study. I can't tell you a thing about modern physics, for instance, because I haven't put the time in to deal with that very highly technical, complex field. But what I'm concerned about in this book and in my own teaching and organizing is not those very technical arenas, but the more basic questions about how power is distributed, about what it means to live a good life, these kind of basic political and philosophical questions that have animated human beings for a long, long time. And in that realm, I want to argue there's no special skill needed. One has to work hard to try and understand the world. It's a complicated place. But it doesn't take some special training in that sense. The problem is, of course, in contemporary America, and in some sense in the world more generally, there is so much time, energy, and money put into what I think we should just call propaganda, advertising, public relations, marketing, the way that governments and corporations spend a whole lot of money trying to control the way we think. You know, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just a description of marketing, public relations, and advertising. It's an attempt to constrain the way we think. And so we always have to try and break out of that. And that, to a large degree, also is what this book is about.
We face an epidemic worldwide. In my opinion, violence against women is endemic to the way in which we relate not only to one another, but also to the way in which we treat Mother Earth and, you know, and our own ability to create a world that is sustainable, that that can sustain life. I feel is interdependent with our ability to eradicate violence as a policy of, you know, success or of advancement. How can we engage people who feel that relationships of power are the result of culture, are the result of nature, are the result of natural predetermination?
Well, I think that's a great place to start, because of course, we live in a world with epidemic levels of violence against women, rape, sexual harassment, domestic violence, child sexual assault. And to a large degree, sadly, people often just accept that as normal, as if that's the way human beings have always lived. And of course, these levels of violence are not a permanent feature of human societies if we go all the way back through human history. There are reasons that we live in that very violent world. It's about hierarchies. One of those hierarchies is the hierarchy and patriarchy of men's domination of women. It's not natural. It's a product of a certain development of societies, actually fairly recently, over the last maybe 5 to 10,000 years. And in the scale of human evolutionary history, that's not a very long time. So I think you're pointing out the need to denaturalize, to challenge the normalizing of these kinds of hierarchies. Violence against women is an indication of that hierarchy in gender. Of course, there are other hierarchies, you know, most notably, at this point, the hierarchies around the distribution of wealth. We have a wildly unequal hierarchical society in the economy. It produces a world in which some people have access to resources that are almost beyond description, while the majority of people on the planet live in some level of poverty. Well, that violates everyone's fundamental moral precepts. I don't care if one is religious or secular. We all have some set of moral principles that depend on recognizing the inherent dignity of all people. And you cannot have a world that honors the dignity of all people with this kind of heavily skewed distribution of resources. So a lot of what I think we have to do in terms of intellectual work these days, and again, we're using the term intellectual not in an elitist sense, not the kind of thing that only people with advanced degrees can do, but a description of the hard work of trying to understand the world. I think one of the most important intellectual tasks today is to break through this assumption that hierarchies are natural, they're inevitable, that there's not much you can do to change them, and to reclaim that deeper spirit of an egalitarian quest for a more equal world in which, in fact, the dignity of all people can be achieved.
In your book, you ask us to think courageously and to reframe ourselves and our world. How do you invite your students to think about what it means to be human, what it means to be a member, you know, among a great family that is sustained by nature?
You know, old people, I'm in the category of old people now, I'm 54 years old. Old people these days love to talk about how young people don't understand things, you know, don't pay attention, don't read enough, too busy playing games. And of course, I think it's appropriate to ask critical questions about the cultural practices of young people. And the point is twofold. One is the question arises, if we don't like what young people are doing, they're too obsessed with texting on their phones or something like that, which old people love to talk about, there's an obvious question. Who created the world in which these young people are living? Well, we did. Old people did. So we're responsible for the practice. The second thing I think is really important is I think often young people have a clearer bead on reality than my generation does. For instance, when I talk to first-year classes of 18, 19-year-olds, and I ask them to reflect on, for instance, the ecological crises, they're all very aware that they're going to live their lives in a world that is in a very, very severe crisis around health of the larger living world. They don't have any illusions about that. In fact, I think they're often much more clear about it than older generations are. And so I find that when I address these things openly and honestly and ask students to imagine what a decent world would look like, what are the values that would animate such a world, they can do it pretty easily. They talk about the need for a world in which people can live a dignified life. They talk about the problems of inequality. They talk about, you know, the lack of a sense of community often. And they know what's going on. And the goal then is to help them analyze why we're in the position we're in. Why is it that in this society wealth is so unevenly distributed? Why do most people in a allegedly democratic society feel completely shut out of the political system? Why do we live in a world where everybody understands we are degrading the environment and yet nothing seems to stop it? These are questions that I think are very much on the minds of young people, and all we have to do is create a climate in which they can pursue this kind of questioning.
I was recently at the World Social Forum and in Tunis, and I was struck by the kinds of discussions that were taking place around the issue of violence against women. And in many ways, I find that Western, I don't know how to say this politely, but there's a certain bigotry about ideas from the West being superior to anything outside. And so I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how this arrogance of our superior knowing not only corrodes but impedes our ability to create and reframe our world in ways that can be more egalitarian, more inclusive, and reflective of our humanity.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I think there's a really valuable lesson in it. So let's take probably the symbol of repression of women in Muslim societies or Arab societies, the burqa, the societies in which women are covered completely so that there is no individual expression. Well, I happen to think that's a cultural practice that's hard to defend. I don't think the burqa leads to a society that's going to promote gender equality. But think about contemporary America. I'll use my home country, which I think is appropriate, where women are routinely encouraged to parade themselves in public in really as sexual objects. Maybe the article of clothing most illustrative of this is the thong. All right, so women in the United States are encouraged to parade themselves for the sexual pleasure of men, whereas women in other societies are forced to cover themselves completely. Are either one of those practices that are likely to produce gender equality? Well, I don't think so. I'm a critic of both of those practices. And so the question arises, well, which is worse? And I think that's the wrong question. The question isn't, do women have it better in the U.S. than they do in Afghanistan, let's say. Well, maybe in certain ways, of course, they do. Women have more freedom in the United States than in Afghanistan. But if you look beyond that superficial analysis, you see deeply embedded patriarchal practices that are really about men's control of women's bodies. And it doesn't matter, you know, which is worse. It matters whether we have the courage to see the underlying problem, the problem of patriarchy. And before we spend all of our time condemning other societies, we do a little critical self-reflection about our own. I think our ability to be part of an international movement, for instance, for gender equality, is much enhanced if we will deal with the problems that we have at home. And there are real problems at home. Those levels of sexual violence you mentioned earlier are, again, not natural. They're a product of a cultural understanding of what women's bodies are for. And so there's a lot of work we need to do at home on that before we start assuming we can correct the problems of the world.
I also wonder if you could comment about the context, because, well, in North America, we could argue that there are certain freedoms, perhaps, that women have struggled for. I mean, women weren't always perceived as independent agents in their own right in this country either. You know, back in 1900s, women were ownership, you know, there were property of men as well. So can we talk about the way in which we tend to objectify the struggles of others when we deny, well, perhaps not deny, but ignore the context in which that struggle is taking place?
Sure. I mean, I think this is one of the great questions of the modern world. We've made great strides toward understanding that people are people, that every one of the 7 billion people on this planet has exactly the same moral status, the same claim to a dignified life. We recognize there's essentially no difference between me and people living a half a world away in moral terms. And we've developed a concept of universal human rights, of the idea that one's right to certain things shouldn't depend on where one lives or what culture one is born into. If we believe in the rights of women, then we have to believe in that in a universal sense. But of course, cultural practices do differ, and it's often easier to see the problems in cultural practices of another society than of our own. So we're constantly both trying to make good on this claim of universal rights and support the struggles of people in other cultures for claiming those rights. And yet we also have to be critically self-reflective. Now, as you're pointing out, the West, you know, whatever that means, Europe, the U.S., Canada, these kinds of societies, have often been much better at critiquing others and then using that critique, for instance, as a justification for violence, not necessarily because we're all that concerned about universal human rights, but because that becomes a wedge through which we can justify violence. Certainly, when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan after 9/11, the justification for that was often phrased by the Bush administration as partly a quest to free the women of Afghanistan from patriarchal rule. Well, you know, that was a cover story. I don't think anybody in the Bush administration particularly cared about the status of women in Afghanistan, as evidenced by the way they abandoned such concerns the minute they're not useful for political propaganda. So that's the struggle. I mean, I believe in human rights, and I believe that the cause of human rights can often be misused by powerful nation states. Both things are true. And, you know, like most things in this very complex world, we have to struggle to figure out how to keep those things in balance. But that's what it means to live in a democracy. And we have not only, I think, a right to do that, but we have an obligation to struggle to do that, to try and work this out.
To me, it's been convoluted, you know, the idea of democracy with capitalism, and it's something that I feel we need to not only demystify, but also critique in a way that helps us move away from it.
Right. If you read the political science literature, those folks often talk about how capitalist economies are essential to democracy because capitalist economies create stable middle classes who can participate in politics, and there's a whole argument, and there's some truth to that. But at a more profound level, everyone understands that democracy and capitalism are fundamentally incompatible for a very simple reason. Whatever else one thinks about capitalism, it is a wealth-concentrating system. The capitalist economies all concentrate wealth to different degrees. You know, you can see different levels of that concentration of wealth in different societies, but every capitalist economy is a wealth-concentrating system. In the United States today, it's a particularly obscene disparity between the wealthy and ordinary people. But whatever one thinks about any of that, if you concentrate wealth, it's quite clear you are going to concentrate political power. You know, folks often talk as if economics and politics are in these separate arenas, which is ridiculous. It's all in one arena, and the concentration of wealth affects the distribution of power. And it's a very simple observation. You cannot have an economic system that concentrates wealth and expect to have a political system which distributes power. And we see that today in the United States. The most obvious way we talk about it is the effect of money, the effect of wealth on the political process. A lot of people in the United States, you know, we talk about elections, but a lot of people don't feel like we have meaningful elections because vast amounts of money are spent to affect the outcome of those elections. And beyond two political parties spending money to try and win, the more important effect of this is that if one doesn't have access to that level of funding, one doesn't even get in the game. You see that contemporary corporate capitalism has undermined democracy.
How should we conceptualize or imagine ourselves being free? In your book, you quote, "We are most free when we are most bound to others." Can you speak about this?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book where I deal with kind of aphorisms, phrases that challenge us. I'm a big fan of kind of pithy phrases that make us think. And one I've always been fond of is this claim I often make that we are most free when we are most bound to others, which kind of is counterintuitive. After all, at least in the United States, we're taught that you're free when you don't have to listen to others. But we also understand that, you know, as everyone says, we're a social animal, that our lives have no meaning in isolation. We don't live as individuals. I'm not here talking about some mystical great common spirit or something. I mean, I realize that I'm an individual with my own thoughts and ideas. No meaningful life is lived in isolation from others. In fact, most of how we understand ourselves, the meaning we create in our own lives, is the product of that interaction. And when those ties to other people, communal ties, are weakened, we often feel, understandably, kind of adrift. We don't really feel free. We may be free in some sort of technical sense. We may be free of the constraints of other people. But that's not the way one lives a meaningful life. So real freedom is about that, again, the complex working out of individual differences within a community, a group of people who are committed to living together. That's where the meaning of life comes from. And so the chance to live free, I think, is enhanced when we are more aware of and more committed to those communities. We see the effect of the atrophying of those communities all around us in the United States. I hear this all the time from students who grow up in the suburbs of big cities in Texas, like Houston or Dallas. And a common complaint they have is that they grew up in a world with no meaning. These are often very affluent students. They grew up with every material thing they could need, and they are searching for some sense of meaning because the community they came from was not a community in any real sense. So they had a lot of freedom, but that freedom, in that very narrow sense, didn't answer the deeper human longing for connection.
Can we talk a little bit about this aggressive sense of, I guess in your way you call it arrogance, you know, this arrogant way of knowing that imposes a technological solution to problems that are both political, ecological, social, and economic?
To borrow a phrase from one of my favorite thinkers, Wes Jackson, what you're talking about is the failure of success. If we take the last 200, 250 years of human history, the Industrial Revolution, the way in which human beings found the ability to exploit the dense energy in coal, oil, and natural gas. Well, it's been very successful in the sense that we've created a lot of material comfort, at least for those of us in the more affluent parts of the world. We can transport ourselves in a matter of minutes over distances that used to take days. We have more of everything. Well, all of that seems to be a marker of success, but in fact, we can also see it as a failure. It's successful in the short term in producing an abundance of material goods, but it doesn't, first of all, answer that question about where do we find meaning. And in industrial societies, you see large chunks of the population struggling with anxiety and depression, not because that's a natural phenomenon, I think, but because it's a product of a culture without meaning. And as you're also pointing out, this success in material terms is having a long-term cost on the ability of this larger living world, which we're dependent, the ability of that world to support a large-scale human presence. You know, you can think of it as the bills for the Industrial Revolution are finally coming due. And the bill is much bigger than we could have imagined, and we have no way to pay it. The last roughly 10,000 years of human existence on the planet, when we started agriculture, we started building cities, we started exploiting the larger living world more efficiently, so to speak. Well, that's the period we call civilization. And it turns out that civilization is in some ways extremely uncivilized. It produces societies with great disparities of wealth and power. It produces hierarchies that we feel is sort of at odds with what it means to be a decent human being. And it's destroying the ecological basis for our own lives. Well, that doesn't seem very civilized. It seems pretty crazy. So we've got to find a way to learn from the past, not because we can romantically think we can recreate the past, but because we have to chart a different kind of future. And the first thing is to recognize that very basic concept, that the Industrial Revolution is, in a sense, a story of the failure of success. And once we acknowledge that and stop pretending that we're just going to magically continue this incredible assault on the ecosphere, well, then the quicker we get down to trying to make a decent life for ourselves on this planet.
Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for writing this very insightful book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. I wonder if you could, in parting, you know, tell us what inspires you? What inspires you to imagine not only a world transformed, but a people engaged and able to create those kinds of relationships that can help us imagine, create, and live in a different way?
A long time ago, I realized that the most fun I could have in life was to take on these critical questions and to align myself with others who were willing to make those critiques. I think we have a moral obligation to participate in social movements that challenge concentrated power, but we also have to remember that it's a very rewarding way to lead one's life. I feel particularly kind of fortunate as a professor with a lot of autonomy and a lot of choices to be able to work with people in things like the immigrant worker movement or the worker cooperative movement, two activities I'm involved with a lot these days. That's where the kind of joy comes from. So, you know, I always want to point out to people that making a commitment to social justice, to movements for ecological sustainability, is not simply a sacrifice. In fact, there's a rich and rewarding life and engagement with amazing people when you make those choices. And that's what we have to always remind other people. It's not a sacrifice to live your life this way. In fact, in many ways, it helps provide the meaning that the dominant culture doesn't give us. And so I encourage folks who are struggling to realize that and recognize over the long haul what that kind of choice can mean for you. It's certainly been a great source of joy in my own life.
Thank you again for being with us this morning.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your show.
Thank you.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.